For 40 years, Uri Geller has been regarded as a show business character, but compelling evidence coming to light from declassified documents from a former senior CIA official and scientist who worked for the agency suggest he was indeed the real thing, exhaustively tested and validated by some of the world's leading scientific minds. There's a new book out about it, written by Jonathan Margolis, The Secret Life of Uri Geller, CIA Master Spy, it says, as a question mark, and I'm delighted to welcome the man himself, Uri Geller, to the show. Welcome, Uri. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Bill. Thank you so much for inviting me on your show. And yes, I'm talking to you from Old Jaffa in Israel, where I live now. After 49 years of living abroad with my family, we decided to come back to our homeland.
Oh, wonderful. Were you not living in a house in the UK that was a copy of the White House?
And the house is still there, and indeed it is, in a way, loosely built after the White House. It's in a lovely village called Sonning-on-Thames, right on the River Thames, where we lived for over 34 years.
Wonderful. Would you allow Donald Trump in that house if it was still yours, Uri?
Absolutely. Maybe when he finishes his presidency, he'll buy it.
Yes, he probably...
No, Bill, since you brought up the name Donald Trump, in September, when Donald Trump was at his lowest, you know, being attacked nonstop, left, right, and center, I dared to write on my Facebook this simple line: whether you like him or not, Donald Trump is going to be the 45th president of the United States. And I guess I was right.
You certainly were right. And what an interesting start he's made, eh?
Yes, very, very. He's a very controversial figure, but I think that somewhere in the deeper caves of his mind, he really wants, good things to happen to America and the world.
Yeah.
And we'll just have to wait and see now.
We will indeed. Let's go way back for you, if you don't mind, Uri, and right to the beginning for you. You were born, as you say, in Tel Aviv, but then you moved to Cyprus. You moved to Cyprus, and you were living in Cyprus and when you were 16, and your mother divorced your father, and there's a war on in Cyprus at the time. So can you kind of paint a picture of what Cyprus was like for us then?
Well, it was a very big trauma for me at the age of 10 to go over and live in Cyprus, which is very close to Israel. But, you know, there was, as you said, a war raging. The Greeks were killing the British soldiers. Turks were killing the Greeks. And I've seen every day almost dead bodies, blown up brains. I've seen blood oozing. It was just terrible.
Awful.
And I had to grow up among, you know, amongst this awful war going on. But I survived. My mother married a Hungarian Jew living in Nicosia, capital of Cyprus, and he died from a heart attack, and we were left with a little hotel. It was a bed and breakfast establishment. And the Mossad, the Israeli Mossad, found out that we are from Israel, and they turned our little hotel into a Mossad safe house. So already at the age of 13, where I met Mossad agents, I bent a spoon to one of them, who was called Yoav Shaham. He so was impressed that he told me when I will be 18 to go back to Israel, join the paratroopers, go to officer school, and find him. Because he already had this idea that with telepathy and mind power, I could be probably a great spy. Yoav was killed in a raid, so my dreams were shattered. But already at the age of 12, 13, I was delivering top-secret letters that he would send from Arabic countries, and I had to deliver them into the hands of the consul. So already then, the spark of James Bond, you know, spy films, excited me, and I was very intrigued by that life.
Absolutely. And you were discovered in a rather unusual way, weren't you? It was due to you being a model at the time.
Yes, we were broke. My mother was working very hard, and my dream was to stop her from working, buy her a radio set, buy her some clothes. And the only thing I had is a Vespa, you know, a scooter.
Yeah.
And I used to take my girlfriends around to photo shoots. They were models.
Yeah.
And one day a male model didn't turn up, and the photographer looks at me and says, "Take his place." And I said, "What? You want me to be photographed?" And 2 weeks later, I opened a big you know, national paper, and I see myself full page ad. It was unbelievable. Wonderful. But I started making some money, and then one day I bent a key to a photographer. He freaked out, and he said nobody will believe him, and he invited me to his house party. And that's when I realized, Bill, that what I do is, although it looks trivial, but it's shockingly amazing. It amazes people. And these parties became more and more important and prestigious, from photographers to lawyers to judges to generals. And then one day, the Prime Minister of Israel is in one of these parties, Golda Meir. And I sent her to the loo, to the toilet, and I told her, go to the toilet, lock yourself in, do a secret drawing, and I'll read your mind. She didn't believe me, but she went to the toilet. I'm the only person in the world that ever sent a prime minister to the toilet on command. And I read her mind. She drew a Star of David, and the next day, Bill, was the beginning of my career, because she was interviewed on Israeli radio, and the presenter asked her, can you predict the future of Israel? And she said, don't ask me, ask Uri Geller.
Fantastic.
That was it.
Fantastic. And that's the value of any publicity, isn't it? And in fact, you discovered later on that any publicity is good publicity.
Oh, yes. I was controversial from day one.
Yeah.
You know, people attacked me. They said it's not real. But for me, it was a great cover for my secretive work.
Yeah.
For my work with the CIA and other intelligence agencies. And what happened is, in 1970, the CIA... were very worried, and they were concerned that there are psychics, people who could manipulate computers. That were, the computer age was at its infancy then.
Mm.
They were concerned that Russians had people who would train to erase computer tapes. And when they heard about me, the head of the CIA made a deal with the Mossad, and they let me out of Israel in 1972 and straight into Stanford Research Institute, Palo Alto, California. That's where they studied me. And those documents, the secretive documents and the film that they have conducted with me, and that's only the tip of the iceberg, was released 3 weeks ago because the CIA were sued by Freedom of Information Act, and then they released all these secret documents.
Yes, 13 million pages of them, in fact, and you were in there. The Stanford research stuff is incredible, because that's what every person like you wants, isn't it? Real scientific validation, and that's irrefutable validation for scientists to come out and say, yes, he's the real deal.
Yes, it was very grueling for me, mind you, being tested for telepathy. You know, when you do it on stage, any magician can do it with mirrors or hidden transmitters. But in Stanford, in order to validate my powers, especially of telepathy, they locked me in shielded rooms, Faraday cages, which means there is this metal room which is shielded from all kinds of eavesdropping.
Yep.
And then there were envelopes sealed with secret drawings miles away, somewhere rooms away, and I would duplicate the drawings precisely. And then that wasn't enough, and then I got a call from Langley, Virginia, CIA headquarters. I didn't know who I was speaking with, but it was a high CIA official called Kit Green, and the scientist told the CIA officer that I can see things so far, and the CIA agent answered, no, he can't. And he said, yes, he can, here he is, and he hands me the phone. Now, just to remind you, there were no mobile phones then. There was no internet. There was no Twitter. Mm-hmm. There's no Instagram. There's no FaceTime.
Yep.
It was an old-fashioned phone. And the CIA agent in Langley, Virginia, thousands of miles away from me, says, I'm looking at a book. Can you tell me what I'm looking at? And I drew exactly that page. And what shocked him the most is that he, Kit Green, with his handwriting, wrote on that page the word architectural, and I wrote the same thousands of miles away in Palo Alto, California, and that convinced Kit Green to release, I believe, $8 million for psychical research.
How extraordinary. Some of that, the results of that research and the things they sent you out to do are unbelievable. And of course, people who remember the film with George Clooney, The Men Who Stare at Goats, actually it wasn't a goat and it was based on you. It was a pig, wasn't it?
Yes, he George Clooney played me. I know I'm showing off now a little, or bragging.
It's okay.
But Robert also played me in a movie. So, and the Matrix. I hear a strange sound. Can you hear it too?
Yes, Bill? I can indeed. There's a kind of it's a CIA. Yeah, it's a CIA.
Wait. Hang on. Let me tell you something. That this conversation is being listened to by National Security Agency, no doubt. Wow. If it's not being listened to, it's being recorded because my phones are tapped and so forth. But going back to that, I'm surprised how I managed to spoon bending into world culture. All these movies and singers about spoon bending. But going back to the experiments, then, of course, they started using me. This is really bizarre, this sound.
It is.
Did you ever encounter this before?
Do you know what? The only time I've ever come across this before was when I was interviewing somebody who claimed that they had seen an alien inside the space shuttle.
That's incredible. I do believe in extraterrestrial life, I can tell you that. But then of course I my tasks were really interesting. I had to spy on the Russian embassy or consulate outside in Mexico City. I had to erase floppy disks that were chained to KGB agents.
Incredible.
That were flying out of Mexico to Paris, and then they changed the plane to Moscow with Aeroflot, and I sat behind them in Aeromexico and simply used my mind to erase the floppy disks. Then Senator Claiborne Pell, who was then the head of the American Foreign Relations Committee, flew to England to brief me with Ambassador Max Kempelman, and my task was to convince the Russians to sign the Nuclear Arms Reduction Treaty.
Good Lord.
I know this sounds all like science fiction or spy films, but it's absolutely true, every word I'm saying. They flew me to Geneva. They got me very close to Yuli Vorontsov, who was the head of their Russian arms and space negotiator. I got like 12 inches away from his head, and I bombarded him telepathically, sign, 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 and they signed. So these were amazing tasks, and I loved it because I felt like I'm a living James Bond.
Incredible. Aside from that, you, of course, had a showbiz career, and I get the impression that you handled the fame and fortune quite badly. Would that be fair?
Yes. First of all, going back to controversy, I was being attacked all the time. But because I'm a master, and I say it shamelessly, I'm a master publicist, I'm a master showman, so I knew how to take those attacks and twist them and churn them so they help my career.
Yeah.
And, you know, the only line I can tell you is what Oscar Wilde said 100 years ago. He said, there is only one thing in life worse than being talked about, and that is not being talked about. So the skeptics... The skeptics helped my career, but what they also did, which they didn't understand, is they gave me a cover. It was important for me to be controversial. You know, there was a chap called James Randi,
yes,
who nonstop attacked me. He was, in my opinion, he was obsessed with me.
Yeah.
And that was great. There was a time when I told my manager, Yasha Katz, to come out with an announcement, Uri Geller is a fake. I needed that balance. The show business was a cover for me while I was doing the secret work. And that's basically... Now, then came money. Mm. I found oil and gold for mining companies dousing. I found Pemex, which is the National Oil Company of Mexico, one of the biggest oil offshore oil finds. And the Mexican president, López Portillo, was so impressed that he actually made me a Mexican citizen. I have a Mexican passport, and it's number one, because no one ever got a passport if you're not born there.
Mm.
And that, I couldn't handle the money. It went to my head.
Yeah.
Fame and fortune. I was obsessed. I was on an ego trip. I couldn't care less about anything, just me. It was all ruthless ego and making money. And then I got bulimia. I devoured everything in restaurants, all the desserts, And then I remembered what I've seen in Israel in movies of the Romans would feast, and then they would stick a feather down the throat to throw up, and they would go back to feast. And I did exactly the same, but I was losing weight and weight. And one day, John Lennon, who was my friend in New York, he looks at me, and he says to me, Bill, he says to me, Uri, you know, you look like an Auschwitz survivor. Oh. I was skin and bones, and I was on the way to dying.
Wow.
And he actually saved my life by telling me to find spirituality.
Yes.
And I told him, what is spirituality? I've heard of the word, but what is it? And he sent me to Japan. So I packed up with all my family, with my children, Daniel and Natalie, and my mother and brother-in-law, Hannah, my wife. We landed in Narita in Tokyo, rented a van, drove to Mount Fuji, and disappeared into a forest under Mount Fuji, where I lived for 1 year with my family. And that's where I totally found myself, and I realized that I was not living the right way.
How fascinating. And John Lennon, of course, also believed in life on other planets. We've alluded to it earlier there. And is it correct that he gave you a mysterious egg, which he said was a ticket to another planet?
Absolutely. One day he calls me up. This is in New York. He lived in the Dakota building on the other side of Central Park. I lived on 57th Street. And he says, I need to speak to you. So we met in a hotel. We found like a kind of a heavy curtain, and we sat behind the heavy curtain, and he tells me that he was lying in bed, and this is absolutely true, these are his words, and suddenly there was a light, almost like a sphere of light in the room, which very much reminded me what happened to me when I was 5 years old in an Arabic garden in Tel Aviv. But then he says an extraterrestrial type of a hand emanated out of this sphere. And John stretched out his hand, and this extraterrestrial, whatever it was, entity, put a very unusual object into John's hand. It looks like a brass egg, but it's not, because it's super heavy for its size.
Mm.
And he pulls it out of his pocket, and he gives it to me, and he says, it's yours. And ever since that day, of course, after his death, I carry this egg with me wherever I go. And people ask me, why don't you have it tested? Why don't you have it proved that it is some kind of an extraterrestrial alloy material that has never been seen on Earth? Mm. And my answer is that I'm afraid to test it, because I don't want to find out that it's made in Taiwan. And I really want to believe in John Lennon's words. And that's why I don't care what people say. I believe that he got it from some type of a higher intelligence.
Amazing story. And is it true that not long after he gave you that egg, he was sadly dead?
Yeah, we all know that he was murdered. I'll never forget the day. My secretary calls me up and she says, there's a major commotion under the Dakota building, lots of police cars. I jumped out of bed and I ran there. I ran through Central Park. And before I even got to the Dakota building, there were hundreds, well, I don't know if hundreds, but tens of police cars with the blue lights strobing. And I stopped in my track and I knew that was it. He was dead. And I went back home. I didn't dare to get even close to the building. That is a sad story, but, you know, throughout my career, celebrities, you know, when you become so big, like John Lennon, Michael Jackson, Elvis Presley, you have everything and you can afford anything, and you're always looking for that extra something out there, that supernatural maybe, the mysticism of the universe. Mm. And this is how I got to all these people, including Michael.
Yeah.
Michael was 14 when he came to see my performance in Los Angeles in the Shrine Auditorium. I didn't even know he was there. When I finished my lecture, an usher comes up to me and tells me, do you know Uri Geller? Michael was sitting right there, Michael Jackson. I couldn't believe it. I said, what? You mean the Michael Jackson? And I ran into the lobby, but it was gone. So already at that age, he was interested in probably mind power, spoon bending.
Yeah.
And then decades later, I met him through Muhammad Al-Fayed.
Right.
Whose son died with Princess Diana.
Yes, indeed. And is it fair to describe your relationship with Michael as rocky, or were you firm friends?
We were very, very close friends in the beginning. Mm. And then I did a fatal mistake. I introduced him to a guy called Martin Bashir.
Yeah.
I believe it was from ITV, who convinced me with a letter he pulled out from his wallet, showed me a letter from Princess Diana telling him, you know, praising him for a documentary
yes.
he did about her, or an interview. I can't quite remember. I'm telling you this from the best of my recollection. Mm. And I thought that he would be the right person to do a great documentary about Michael.
Mm.
And I just left them in the hotel to speak, and that was my mistake, because I didn't realize what will happen in the interview. And basically what happened, and I think we all know this, in my opinion, Michael did three devastating mistakes in that documentary.
Yeah.
And I warned him many times. First, I warned him about taking the sleeping pills and doctors. I told him he'll die if he continues it. Mm. And then I also told him he can't speak about his love for children, because the people out there look at it in a suspicious eye.
Yeah.
And not, Michael was totally innocent. I mean, I hypnotized Michael, and I wanted to know the truth. And I asked him under hypnosis, Michael, did you ever touch a child in an inappropriate manner? And he immediately answered, no, I would never do that.
Mm.
So to me, it was clear that the man was innocent, but he was talking about the children and holding the hand of a 13-year-old kid. You don't do that in a documentary.
Yeah.
And I think that was his downfall. And after that, you can imagine how angry he was on me. Mm. But then, just before he died, he came to England to promote This Is It, his show. And I wasn't home, and he left a message on my machine that he wanted to see me. So that's the story of Michael Jackson. But he was always a legend. He was an icon.
Yeah.
He was a phenomenon, Bill, a phenomenon. And I think he's up there with Elvis Presley and John Lennon and Frank Sinatra. Because
yeah.
I do believe in life after death.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it, that people who shine that brightly don't tend to shine that brightly for long, and they're taken from us too soon.
Yeah, that is true. And this is why today, when I talk about spirituality, mind power, you know, I try to influence or motivate people, because I look at myself and I tell everyone out there, if you can go there with your mind, you can go there with your body.
Mm.
And what you can visualize, Bill, you can materialize, because there is nothing you can't be, do, or have. Because at the end of the day, you are the architect of your own life. Mm. So the spoon bending is so, it's not important, all the powers that people read about me doing. Put all that aside. When I get emails from children, Mr. Geller, teach us how to bend a spoon. Mm. I tell them, forget spoon bending. Instead, focus on school, believe in yourself, become a positive thinker, go to university, believe in, create a target goal to be successful. And that's it. And to all your listeners, please do check out my website, which is urigeller.com. You will find The Secret Life of Uri Geller by Jonathan Margolis there, or from Amazon. It's not my book. He wrote the book about me. But you'll also find something that will prove once and for all that I really possess genuine powers.
Mm.
And I'll tell you what that is, if I still have a minute with you.
Of course.
In Euro 96, England was playing Scotland in Wembley. And I was asked by a group of people, of course, I was living in England, to help England beat Scotland. They put me in a helicopter, and we were not allowed to fly over Wembley because the airspace is closed there. And we had to go around Wembley in the helicopter, and I have headphones on my head because I could hardly see the players from that height. Suddenly I hear, that the Scottish striker, Gary McAllister, got a penalty.
Yeah.
So he puts the ball down, and I say in my mind, I'm not going to have this happen. I'm going to move the ball away from his foot.
No!
And in the helicopter, when Gary McAllister started running towards the football, I shouted, I screamed in the helicopter. And someone photographed me in the helicopter. I screamed, 1, 2, 3, move! Lo and behold, Bill, the ball moved away from his foot. Seaman caught the ball, and England won. And you can see that on my website because the BBC had cameras running. Obviously, it's Wembley. It's Euro 96. You won't believe your eyes.
Uri, so, I've got to tell you, you're talking to a Scot here, and so now I know who's responsible for Gary McAllister missing that penalty.
Oh, you never knew that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. Well, listen to this, Bill. I got thousands of hate letters from Scotland, and what I decided to do to relax your anxiety is that I said it was highly unethical. I should have not done it because it's basically interfering with the match. I can motivate people, inspire, but not move a football away. When you watch that film, which is on my homepage or the second page, I decided to give back something to Scotland. So I went to Scotland and I bought an amazing island called Lamb Island.
Right.
So I'm the owner of a Scottish island. So I feel partly Scottish.
Oh, wow. That's neatly got out of you. Well done. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. The book is brilliant. The Secret Life of Uri Geller, CIA Master Spy. As you say, written by Jonathan Margolis, but wholly endorsed by your good self. It's been brilliant to talk to you, Uri. All the best to you, sir.
God bless. Love you all.
Take care. Bye-bye.